Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Life of Caesar podcast, episode 4.
Yay.
If you haven't listened to episodes 1, 2, and 3, what are you doing? Like, seriously.
Wasting their time.
Don't you know how this works? Don't start at episode 4. Stop right now. Sure. Go back to episode 1. Unless you're, you have a reading disorder, in which case I apologize. With me, as always, on the Life of Caesar podcast, my eminent co-host, the brains behind the operation, historian, lover, man of the world, Ray Harris. Tell us your news for the week, Ray.
Okay, so for episode number 4, my basement has been flooded, everything has been packed away and boxed away, and so my life has been a complete wreck for the last week. Instead of my nice office that I get to smoke in while we record the show, I am now in my daughter's playroom. There's pink everywhere, and I am sitting at a table about the fourth of a size of a normal table, and it's got Dora the Explorer all over it, and I'm sitting in a little tiny chair, again, Dora, and so I will be brave enough to have a picture of this taken so I can show you what I've been putting up with for the last week or so.
That is awesome. I can't wait to see that photo. Fortunately for us and all the audience, everything you need is in that 6 inches between those, in that beautiful head of hair. That's all we need.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah, let's go with that. So if I'm the brains, I guess you're the looks.
Well, apparently, according to at least one reviewer on iTunes, I'm the guy that just goes off on tangents all the time.
But, see, I'm not brave enough to go off. You know, you've got your charisma and all that stuff, and when you're winging it, I think it's pretty funny. But I guess some people just really, really love Caesar, and they want us to stick to the script.
Well,
so who knows?
No chance of that. Listen. You know, if the person who wrote that comment on iTunes is listening, yes, Godzilla love you, my friend. But
there we go.
Here's the bottom line. You may think we're here to convey facts. We're not. We're here to discuss history in a fun, we hope, an enjoyable, breezy manner. If you want to get down and dirty into the facts, go listen to another podcast or go to university, read a book. The idea of these shows, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Ray, but I'm still thinking you're probably the person who wrote that comment. It was a passive aggressive way of passing your feedback on to me. It's
until you can prove it.
Look, it's to give people an enjoyable overview to the subject of the life of Caesar, right? We don't want to be serious. We don't want to be boring. Yeah. We want to have a good time. History can be fun.
Yeah. It should be fun.
I think it should be fun. I enjoy our chats.
Wasn't Caesar having fun when he was crucifying those thousands of pirates? I mean, just good times for everybody. It's in the eye of the beholder.
And that's
except for the pirates.
And so that's where we left it off at the end of episode 3. Caesar, captured by pirates, comes up with the ransom. They let him go. He comes back, captures them, takes them prisoner, and ends up having them all crucified. But as we pointed out last time, had their throats cut first because he's a good guy.
He's a gentleman. And he promised them that he would, when he was their captive, he promised them he would do that.
Not the cutting the throats bit, but just the...
crucifying.
But it was a bit of a joke. It was like, hey, if I ever get out of here, I'm probably going to come back and crucify you. And they're like...
Dead meat.
And they're like, sure you are. You're such a hoot. So
that's probably what got him the biggest laugh at the time.
With
the pirates.
Yeah. So, and like as we talked about last time, I've been thinking about this more since our last show. Like it really goes a long way to start to give you an indication of the sort of character that this guy is. He was kind of serious.
Yeah.
So We're now, so after that, we mentioned again, just at the end of the last show, he, after he crucified the pirates, he set off to do what he was trying to do in the first place when he was captured, which is to go to Rhodes to study oratory under the famed teacher Apollonius.
Mm-hmm.
Not the woman that married Prince in the 90s, I have to point out. That was Apollonia.
Ah, I didn't know that. Okay.
Apollonia. This is Apollonius.
I like her better, but anyway.
Greek rhetorician, who was also the teacher of Cicero, you know, probably the most famous man of words that has come down to us from ancient Roman history.
Right.
So Caesar goes and does that, and then we don't really know much about what happens in that time of his life. He never really talked about it, never really wrote about it. There's really no rumors that were going around. As far as we know, he just was a good student.
Yep.
And then what happens next?
Yeah, so he's doing his studies, and just because drama can't seem to leave this guy alone, sometime in 74 BCE, Mithridates, even though he's an old man now, is once again ready to take on the Roman Republic. So he again invades the Asia province, and he sends some troops to, is it Bithynia? Where does he send them to? He sends them to Asia Minor. And Caesar hears about this. So Mithridates, his Pontic troops have broken out all over again, and all the Romans are again frayed because 7 years ago or whatever, a whole bunch of them were slaughtered. And Caesar hears about this, puts down his stylist or whatever he's writing with and on, and he literally goes to Asia, finds where some of the troops are at, and he literally raises an army from the local communities, leads the army. And again, he's a very young man. He's a bravatus. He is not involved in the government or a military. He leads them, and they're able to beat back the Pontic troops in that particular area. They push him out. Caesar says, okay, I did my part. And he goes back to Rhodes and again picks up his studies. Just like no big deal.
Yeah. So, I mean, what do we take away from this? I mean, he's obviously devoted to his studies, but he's ready to be called upon when he needs to be. But, you know, he's, you would think that a man of this level of ambition might be trying to be in Rome and climbing his way up the ladder of power, but he seems to recognize that the key to gaining power is having a way with the words. You have to be in Rome at the time. You have to be very proficient as an orator, as a speaker, as a rhetorician.
Right.
Yeah.
Almost like just an actor on a stage. Absolutely. He's got to be the total package.
Yeah. And you know, we can draw analogies, I guess, to this day and age. I mean, the vast majority of professional politicians in this day and age get media training. And I guess this was the equivalent of media training in ancient Rome. You had to be able to command an audience.
Absolutely. Yep. But at the same time, obviously, he's not just a good writer. He's not just a good speaker or maybe what they would call a good lawyer. He's obviously a man of strategy and tactics because he's able to, you know, again, with the pirates and now with the Pontic troops in Asia. I mean, he's just showing that he's a very in a broad way, very talented, very intelligent, passionate, serious, focused person, and to run up against him is, you know, not a good thing for the enemy because he's obviously a very capable young man.
Indeed. And so the next step then in his progression is he is appointed to a priesthood. Now, he had previously been, we know, the Flamen Dialis. I think we talked about that in episode one.
Right,
which was very restrictive, but this new post is less restrictive, and it's also a very important post for somebody who wants to have a. We don't think of it these days. You don't become a priest and then work your way up to being a president or a politician. Usually, it's not a career path these days. But in ancient Rome, that was actually a respected, you know, part of the career ladder, wasn't it?
It was all, exactly right. It was also an indication that he was seen as an up-and-comer. So his relative is Gaius Aurelius Cotta, who's one of the priests. He's dying. He has to be replaced. The main priest, obviously, is the Pontifex Maximus. And I think through family connections and whatnot, Caesar gets this post. He didn't run for it. He was chosen, and he finds out in, I think at the end of 74, early 73 BCE, that he's been made a priest. And so he's ready to put down his lessons in Rhodes and head back to Rome and accept this honor, which is a very good thing for him. Again, one more rung on the ladder to moving up to the consulship, which is his ultimate goal.
And there were 15 pontiffs, right, headed by the Pontifex Maximus, as you said.
Selective group, yeah.
Yeah. And if, you know, you lived long enough, having been a pontiff, you would usually become a consul. So it was almost a sure bet, if he could survive past that point, that his political career was somewhat assured.
Right. So, yeah, so he's moving up. And this is also what roughly the time his wife gives birth to his only legitimate daughter, Julia. So he accepts this position, and now he's got again start mixing it up in Rome. So he goes back to the law courts, and he starts prosecuting more well-known men. Again, he's going to lose most of these, but he's going to get his name out there, and that's pretty much what he's trying to do.
He was a priest and a prosecutor.
There you go. You can't get any better than that.
I mean, it's weird, right, from a modern perspective, to think about somebody who's both a priest and a prosecutor. But there you go. That was Rome. We know at some date around this period, he represented Nicomedes' daughter, Nysa. And, of course, as mentioned previously, Cicero at this stage is said to have said, we remember that Caesar allegedly had a homosexual relationship with Nicomedes, and Cicero said, no more of that, please, when everyone knows what he gave to you and what you gave to him.
That's right. Yeah, the rumor started coming up again when he defended the king's daughter. So again, but it's just the price he had to pay. But again, in some ways, there's no bad press. His name was getting out there, and he was recognized, and that's the key to winning his next election.
That's right. Now, the next step in his career is he gets elected to be a military tribune. Do you want to talk about what a military tribune was, Ray?
Well, I think there were a certain number of them. And again, this is something he actually had to run for and win. So being elected a pontiff is nice. But when you actually actively go out and win, again, it just says that he's an up-and-comer. Take this man seriously because he's going places. So he's going to be, I think, was it one of a certain number of military tribunes that he would eventually go out, work underneath a governor or something like that, and again, get more experience. But again, it's a very one more step on the ladder to having the success that he wants.
Yeah, a military tribune was an officer in the Roman army. They kind of ranked above a centurion but below a legate. And they were usually young men, come from the equestrian class typically. It was seen as a stepping stone to the Senate. Not to be confused, of course, with the political office of the tribune of the people. So it was a different thing, but still use the term. The word tribune, of course, or tribunus in Latin, comes from the root tribus, which means tribe.
Right.
And, you know, if you go back to Rome's earliest history, there were three tribes, the Ramnes, the Luceres, and the Titties, my favorite. And because Rome didn't have a standing army, whenever there was a requirement for an army, the three tribes would send a commander in of their own tribe, and this was the military tribune. And they would have a legion of, you know, originally there was a legion of about 3,000 soldiers.
The support troops, yeah.
Yeah. So around about the time of the Republican period, though, there were about six military tribunes for each legion. But only two at a time. Like, you had two consuls at a time, you'd have two military tribunes at a time that had authority, and they were sort of rotated. So, yeah, it was a a powerful position, particularly for a guy that didn't have a huge amount of military experience at the time. But so, as we said, that was Caesar's next step, military tribune, probably around about 72 or 71 BCE.
Right. And the key thing, like you said earlier, was that he was now an officer. So he's not just in the rank and file. He's obviously using his status and his place in society as an aristocrat. And so now he's an officer. So he's kind of made this big leap to going from not too much military experience to being an officer. So he's moving up very quickly and very fast. And again, he's still a young man. He's not even 30 years old yet.
We don't really know a lot about what happens to him at this time. None of the sources that we have really give a lot of detail. But one of the things we do know that was going on in Italy at the time was one of the great slave wars. I think it was the Third Servile War, ran from about 73 to 71 BCE, also known as the Gladiator War or the War of Spartacus.
Yes.
I am Spartacus, Ray.
I will call you that from now on.
No, no, you're supposed to say, I am Spartacus. You haven't seen the Kirk Douglas film, man?
It's been a long time. Oh, I'm sorry.
Come on.
I'm
sorry. Oh, I'm fail. Sorry. Major fail. I am Spartacus. I am Spartacus. So it's worth talking a little bit about the slave war, I think, here, because we don't know much about what Caesar was doing, but we do know quite a bit of detail about the Third Servile War. So basically around this time, what was happening was there was this big uprising, and there had been uprisings of slaves before. But the key thing to understand about the Third Servile War is when we think of slave uprisings, we might think of it from a United States perspective, and you might think of poor people out in the cotton farms raising up and fighting their southern owners. You might think it's Django Unchained and
testosterone. Yeah,
they're wearing frilly costumes and shooting racist white people, but you know, that wasn't necessarily the case. A lot of the slaves that were involved in the Third Servile War were actually gladiators, as was Spartacus. So Spartacus himself has we don't know a lot about Spartacus's life. We believe he came from Thrace. He was a gladiator at the time. There's a lot of, well, different stories in the ancient sources about his background. They think he was born probably around about 109 BCE. In Thrace, which would now be like sort of the Balkans, Bulgaria, around there. And there are some different stories that he may have been attached to the Roman army at some stage. He may have been a soldier or a deserter or a robber. You know, we have different stories from Plutarch and some other authors from that period. What everyone agrees upon, though, is for whatever reason, he ended up as a gladiator, and you know, being made to fight, and you know, not a good life. We all know what everyone's seen my Australian compatriot Russell Crowe's film Gladiator, I'm sure. Terrible actor Russell Crowe, terrible. Actor.
But you put a sword in his hand and boom, it's all okay.
But yeah. You don't want to mess with him when he's got a sword. No. Or a phone. Well known.
Yeah, no,
for
please don't.
Hitting
don't
people
piss him
in
off.
The head with phones. Yeah.
They probably deserved it, but that's not the point.
And so, again, we don't know a lot about the beginnings of the uprising with the Servile War, but we do know that Spartacus was one of the chosen leaders. Crixus and Onomaus were the other two. You know, unfortunately, Kirk Douglas never made movies about them, so they've been forgotten in history. Yeah. But the story of the uprising is that there were there was like a bunch of gladiators that were plotting an escape. These gladiators were being trained at a school near Capua, belonging to Lentulus Batiatus, and they were planning an escape, but the plot was betrayed. But about 70 of them seized kitchen implements.
Right.
Spatulas and whisks.
But they are warriors.
Predominantly.
They are warriors.
Hey, you've never seen a whisk until you've seen a gladiator with a whisk, my friend. So they seized kitchen implements and fought their way out of the school again with... Mm-hmm. And not the big spatulas, just those little...
The little ones.
The little tiny ones that you use when you're making sauce. And
but the anger behind the whisk is what matters.
And those little tiny espresso teaspoons that you have for the little espresso cups. But that's all they needed.
Yeah.
So they fought their way free from the school. They seized several wagons of gladiatorial weapons and armor. And then they had to spend an hour going... Should we keep using the espresso spoons or the swords? And they had a big debate about it.
It was a close vote.
It was a close call, but they ended up deciding to keep to go with the gladiatorial weapon just for tradition's sake, if nothing else.
Right.
A force was sent after them. They escaped, and they ended up on Mount Vesuvius.
Mm-hmm.
And then they started to grow their numbers. They ended up, Ray, with nearly 120,000 slaves on their side.
Yeah, and it didn't matter that they weren't trained professionals, soldiers, but because a lot of them were, the core were gladiators, but the other ones were frustrated slaves who had been working, you know, in pretty much a crappy life. And so they would run away from home, and they heard about this, and they would run, and they would flock to Spartacus and his army. And like you said, it just swelled very quickly before, you know, it got to the point he didn't know what to do with them. But it was a very impressive event, and it scared the heck out of the people in Rome.
As you can imagine.
Yeah,
100. I mean that's a reasonable sized army.
Yeah.
So they're going around. There's not a. We don't really know what they were trying to achieve. I mean, there are some stories that say that Spartacus was trying to end slavery,
mm-hmm.
But some people believe he was just trying to get home. But that doesn't make sense because they headed south and Thrace would have been north. But so we don't really. They didn't issue a set of declarations or principles. They didn't nail their 95 theses to the church wall.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I guess they just were doing what they were doing.
Well, at this point, I mean, if you think about it, he never planned for this. And suddenly he's got all these people who are relying on him. He's got to feed them. And they are dangerous men that are with him, that are following him. And it's clear to me from what I read that there is no overall objective. Okay, what the heck do we do now besides not let a Roman army come and kill us all? So I'm sure it was very confusing times, but at the same time, I'm sure it was very heady for him. They defeated one Roman army after another. And so, again, an army without an objective is a very dangerous thing for everybody, even that army.
Mm. According to one of the histories written by Appian, at one stage, Spartacus captured about 300 Roman soldiers and made them fight to the death, gladiator style.
Right.
Ultimate
revenge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So eventually, I mean, to cut a long story short with the whole Servile War thing, they ended up being successful for several years, as you said, until Marcus Licinius Crassus, the wealthiest man in Rome, and former friend of Sulla, decided to pull a Sulla. No, he didn't. He didn't.
Well, no one else wanted the job.
He didn't pull a Sulla, but he did say, "All right, I'll do it. I'll go and put down this rebellion."
Yeah, there's been two consular armies that have been beaten. Another large force was beaten, and he was the only one who would do it because some of the things I read was that if you're a Roman aristocrat and you want to make your name, I mean, if you lead a war, a successful war against a bunch of slaves, I mean, it's not like invading a country. There's no fame. There's no money to be had. All the prisoners that you would normally sell into slavery, they were already former slaves. They were going to have to be killed to teach everyone a lesson. There's nothing in it for anybody. But Crass is like, well, I'm already one of the richest men around, and I do need to make a name for myself, even if it's not the traditional way to move up the political ladder. So in some ways, he was the only one who really wanted the job, and he took it. But at the same time, he knew what he was doing.
Yeah. And he was he was given a force of somewhere between 32 and 48,000 trained Roman infantrymen, plus their auxiliaries, which would have been quite large. And what he is known in this period, Crassus that is that he treated his legions with a fair amount of discipline and brutality, and reviving the old punishment of decimation. Now, you know, people, you know, we use the word something was, you know, somebody was decimated, or the land was decimated, but I don't know that everyone knows where the term comes from.
Yeah. Well, I just want to throw this out real quick. When I first read about this, I was like 14 years old, and I didn't know what decimation was. And I'll let you describe it. But by the time I finished reading that, I was like, holy crap, my God, that they would do that, and that the men would actually let themselves be decimated. It just shook me. So I can imagine what it did to this army. I mean, I'm sure it made them angry. It desensitized them to violence, and Crassus got what he wanted out of them.
Yeah. Yeah. So decimation, dec, D-E-C, like in December, which was originally the 10th month of the year, decade, we know that that means 10. So it was a form of military discipline where you would normally punish people for, or your soldiers for, capital offenses like mutiny or desertion, or sometimes just for not fighting hard enough.
Right. Their morale was low.
Yeah, and so decimation meant removal of a tenth. So what they would do is they would divide the troops up into groups of 10. Each group would draw lots, and the soldier who got the shortest straw was executed by his 9 comrades, either usually by stoning or clubbing.
And then, it wasn't anything fast. It was nice and slow.
Getting your throat cut here.
Right, right.
And then the remaining soldiers, the 9 that survived and had to execute their friend and colleague, were given rations of barley instead of wheat for a few days as punishment, and then made to camp outside of the rest of the camp. They had to set up their tents outside of where the rest of the army was as punishment. So, and so you basically didn't know. Imagine standing there and drawing straws.
Right. And you're looking at each other. Yeah.
Yeah. To see whether or not you're going to die. And it didn't matter what your rank was, any distinction. It fell upon everyone equally.
Yeah. And just devastating. I'm sorry. Just devastating.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was decimation. That's what Crassus re-implemented. It hadn't been fashionable, but Crassus was like, well, you know, I mean, you can imagine after Spartacus's army had been victorious for several years, the Roman troops going in were kind of like, they probably weren't the most confident of troops. You know, if other armies before you have gone in and had their asses kicked,
right,
repeatedly by this bunch of slaves, you're probably, you know, not exactly going in there with a winning attitude.
Right. But see, I think that says something about Crassus. Let's say Caesar was 10 years older and he was put in charge of this army to go up against Spartacus. You would think that he would have come up with something, some other way for them to rekindle that martial spirit and to become the effective fighting machine that he did. I think it's interesting that Crassus just chose this way to really shock this army that was now given to him in order to say, okay, you're going to go fight and you might die, but you're going to kill, you know, you're going to try very hard to kill. I just think Caesar would have come up with some, or maybe Pompey the Great would have come up with some other way, but Crassus chose this and it was brutal, but it was effective.
Yeah, well, it's the carrot or the stick thing, you know. Caesar may have come up with some sort of a reward for the troops to get them to fight harder, but and Crassus, as we've said, was one of the, if not the, richest man in Rome at the time, and you know, could have provided some incentives, but no, he did this, and apparently he did it to prove that he was more dangerous to them than the enemy was.
Right, fear me more than you do the enemy. That's a very normal leadership tactic. Sometimes good, sometimes bad, but a lot of leaders do that.
So anyway, you know, it worked. Crassus was able to... He had some setbacks earlier on, but eventually managed to engage Spartacus, defeated him, killed about 6,000 of the rebels, captured Spartacus. There's some different stories about actually what happened to Spartacus, whether or not he was... killed or executed or killed in the battle. There are different stories according to the different sources. But what we do know is the aftermath was famously brutal.
Right.
There were a bunch of slaves that were captured, around about 6,000. And what happened to them, Ray?
Crassus, because he is such a rich person and he has a lot of slaves, and the slaves have been causing a lot of trouble over the last couple of years. Like we said, this is the third servile war. He's going to use these people who survived the battle to teach all the slaves on the peninsula a lesson. So he lines up all 6,000. I can't remember the exact distance apart along the Appian Way, but he literally has them crucified. And he doesn't do what Caesar does. He doesn't cut their throats. And so they are literally going to hang there for the longest time until literally the clothes and skin start coming off. And it's just going to freak everybody out. And there's just going to be this long line of slaves who revolted. And this was what would happen to you if you thought about doing it in the future. It was, again, brutal, but very effective.
6,000 slaves crucified.
I can't comprehend that.
All along the Appian Way from Rome to Capua. I mean, it is like the most, one of the most brutal episodes I can think in history. Now, something I neglected to mention before is in the latter stages of the Third Servile War, Pompey was... Pompey was engaged in the battle. Yeah, you got to love Pompey. And he actually captured about 5,000 rebels that were fleeing the battle. He didn't engage Spartacus's troops directly, but he captured about 5,000 rebels, killed them all, and then sent a dispatch to the Senate saying, well, look, you know, Crassus may have conquered Spartacus in open battle, but I'm the one who actually ended the war.
Right, I wrapped it up.
Yeah.
He just gotten back from Spain, being victorious there. So he comes back, literally does nothing except for gets stragglers, but he declares that he finished it. And of course, Crassus, who already hates Pompey, now he truly does. And so he just comes in again. He's a rock star. He comes in, he takes total credit for ending the war, and Crassus just sees red.
Yeah. And so that's an important factor in what's going to happen next. And also, We assume that Crassus and Caesar probably got to spend some time together during this period. Caesar being a military tribune, Crassus being a commander of the army. Obviously, you know, they become quite close later on, as do Caesar and Pompey. And so this period of the Servile War, though we don't know a lot about what Caesar was doing at this time, historians assume that his friendship with Crassus was probably cemented during this period, which was very, very important to Caesar during his own political career.
And not only that, but Crassus, I think we might have mentioned this before, Crassus was lending a lot of money out to different people, especially if they looked like an up-and-comer. And I'm sure Caesar was one of those people who got money from him so he could spend lavishly and get attention. So that relationship... Because Crassus is going to spend money on a lot of people, knowing that some of them are going to make it to the top, and suddenly he's got a friend. So, yeah, so Caesar's able to keep his career going by borrowing money from Crassus. They work together at some level during the war, and again, that friendship is going to factor hugely in the next couple of years.
So, what happens next? Where do you want to pick it up after that?
Let's see here. So you've got, here's what Rome has to worry about. Once again, there are two leaders with two armies on the peninsula. You know, they're semi close to Rome. The enemy's been wiped out. What is Crassus and what is Pompey going to do? Are they going to fight each other? Are they going to join up? Are they going to march on Rome? Are we going to have Sulla all over again times two? So the good news is the slave revolt is now gone. But now we've got these two giant armies. What the hell is going to happen? And Rome is very nervous about what's going on to their south. And they're just fearing what's coming next.
And that's where we're going to pick it up in episode 5 of the Life of Caesar podcast, when Ray will yet again be at the Dora Explorer desk.
Yes, I will. And I just want to say that just to give you a hint of what's coming, And you never know what degree, you know, this really happened, but at some point Caesar is able to get Crassus and Pompey to the peace table. They work out an agreement. They don't end up fighting, and suddenly you have this powerful group of three men, and they are going to help steer the course of Rome in a very intense way. And again, this is Caesar just taking him, using these two men. He doesn't regard them as his betters. As far as Caesar goes, there is no one better than him. But he's going to use these two men and their very different talents, and he's going to propel himself further up the ladder, closer to his ultimate goal of being a consul.